What topicos did you?
It's a book. It was adapted. Who hath wrought this? What did they do? What makes it bad? Where my gay shit at? Characters.
Truly, though, where my gay shit at?
Well, I mean, you do have the sex scene.
I guess. Well, I'll put it like this. We have one gay sex scene to how many hetero ones?
Well, two, right? I guess. Well, I guess there's all the stuff with Phlox.
One scene of charged looks in a car. The two wet dudes.
Like a near kiss.
That is like third base to me. Chris, I meant to ask
you. I think we can power through this one pretty quickly.
Chris, what did I tell you about fucking saying that? Every time you say that, we end up taking 2 hours.
True enough.
Never fucking say this.
I take it back. We're going to have so much to say.
Yeah, yeah. So please, stop saying that.
What was your question?
I was going to say, as you know, I've been watching a lot of Murder, She Wrought lately. And... She hath wrought this murder. Do you remember the one episode, one of the many episodes, where she goes to California and there is someone she used to have in a writing class or something is like an intern or a PA on the TV show Buds, which is very much a Friends knockoff to the point, like, you see the set and it looks
like...
This
is like in like the later seasons.
Probably. Yeah. I couldn't tell you because they're just playing them at random on Roku TV. But the premise is that it's like, it's a similar to Friends where it's like three hot guys and three hot girls and they live in a city and they're young and they tell jokes. It's a sitcom. And the premise is like, at one point, they're worried that one of the buds is going to be written out, which I love that they keep saying that on the show. Everyone's like, I hear they're going to let one of the buds go. It's like, did they say that about Friends in the 90s where they called
one
like
the
Friends?
Will go.
Right. They say, like, I think one of the Friends might leave the show soon. Like, did we ever say that? Maybe we did. But anyway, and so then as I'm watching this, I'm like, okay, so they're going to, like, write someone out. And then you see what they have written for this. Five of them are sitting in this not coffeehouse cafe set. And a police officer enters and is like, I have bad news. The sixth bud has been killed in a car accident. Which, can you imagine if, like, at the end of season 5 of Friends, it ends with, like, a police officer walking to Central Park and be like, bad news, guys, Rachel's dead. Like, my assumption was just they would be like, she's going to Maine to live with her friends or something. But instead, they're like, she's dead now.
I do remember this vaguely.
Do they say the sixth bud has been killed?
Yes.
No, they don't refer to it. It does feel like, sir, a second plane has hit the tower.
Right.
Sir, a sixth bud has been plastered by a taxi cab.
Just the podcast with three friends.
Three friends watch a deeply, deeply troubled, deeply shitty movie. Talk about what worked, what didn't work, how they could fix it, all while enjoying a themed cocktail. Thank you both for joining me at the Lamont, a mile above the Allegheny River overlooking the city of Pittsburgh. I am your host for this episode, Brendan. When a girl asks you if you like pie, there's really only one answer. Trishler.
I'm Chris. Baltimore's great city art. Ravel.
And I am Lee. I am hungry as a motherfuck, Delahanty.
Oh, man.
And we're all doing some really good vocal work here. I'm doing my best. John Foster's detached sense of nothingness. Chris is reaching deep down into the depths of his bowels to, like, draw up the bile that Nick Nolte's voice needs.
I'm doing my Europe, Asia, Pan accent.
Right. Yes, yeah, sort of like vaguely nebulous, Middle Eastern, East Asian, South Asian.
Everywhere. Yeah. Everywhere possible you could imagine.
This is going to be a demo reel for all of us as voice actors.
Yes, exactly.
Right?
Like, that was always my hope. Finally, I can cover for Nick Nolte when he's not around.
Finally.
Obviously, as I'm sure you can tell by those nicknames, the movie that we are covering is The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, directed by Rawson Marshall Thurber, who directed Dodgeball. The movie came out in 2008, but was shot, I believe, in 2006 and kind of sat on a shelf for a while. Go fig.
I cannot, with a gun to my head, could have told you that this man's other famous credit would have been Dodgeball.
Do you want to know what else this guy has done?
I would love to know.
We're the Millers.
Okay, weird. That's actually kind of a functional comedy.
Red Notice. Remember that one?
Yeah, that's bad.
With Gal Gadot. Dodgeball. Skyscraper with The Rock. You remember?
What?
Yeah, I think he might just be like one of The Rock's guys at this point.
Is he maybe also a bit of a like a hired hand kind of guy?
I think this is what he looks like. Like, this is one of the broest looking guys I've ever seen.
Did he used to be a Matt Damon stuntman?
He looks kind of like that dude what plays Reacher.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Alan Rich.
Yes, he does. He has, like, right. He does have, like, that enormously swole, like, huge
neck.
Yeah.
Wow, he's kind of hot.
No, he is. It's one of those things where it's like, he's super bro-y looking. So when you look at everything else he's done, and you look at this, it's like, most of these movies make sense coming from this guy. This one, I'm a little bit like, really?
And obviously,
this was it?
Obviously, we'll get into this, but something actually kind of clicked when you were giving me more of his credits. Dodgeball, what was the other comedy?
We're the Millers.
We're the Millers, and Skyscraper in particular. I could see that maybe the direct... those are actually, like, functional,
no,
like,
I've heard that.
Movies.
Yeah, I've heard this, like, they
so,
work.
But I could see how maybe the person that can do that well could not do this
right.
well.
But it's... I want to cover, because I think this whole, like, how this came to be is kind of weirdly fascinating. Yeah, okay. Obviously, this is based off of a book, so we'll talk about that a little bit. But before we get too into the weeds here, we need to cover, of course, the drink that we made for this episode. The drink that we made is called the Cloud Factory. It's 1.5 ounces of cold espresso, 4 ounces of coconut milk, 2 ounces of coffee liqueur, and whipped cream. To make the whipped cream, you need 2 ounces of cold, heavy cream, 1 teaspoon of smoked maple syrup, and then there's a little bit of sea salt to top all of that off. To make the drink, you add the espresso, the coconut milk, and the coffee liqueur to a shaker with ice, shake it till it's chilled, pour it into a mug over ice. For the whipped cream, in a metal bowl, you whisk heavy cream and the maple syrup until stiff peaks form. When I was making this, I added a little bit of vanilla pudding mix to it so that the whipped cream would keep for the journey over to Lee's. And honestly, it really does keep. It's kind of weirdly fascinating. Like, if you ever need whipped cream to stay in the shape of whipped cream, add some vanilla pudding mix. Because it will, like, there is still a glob. Yeah. There's, like, a dome of whipped cream at the bottom of my drink when I was still done that had not melted at all. So, like, honest to God, good. Thank you very much, America's Test Kitchen.
Straight on my hot chocolate tonight.
I will also.
I think that would be terrific for it. Also, yeah. I might whip up another batch of it at home to do it for that.
Okay, I will have to say this is pretty much like a perfect drink.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Well, you pour that in the drink. The whipped cream goes on top, and then you sprinkle some sea salt on the whipped cream on top. But yeah, so
The whipped cream was so deliciously decadent and thick. I loved how not very sweet it was. The maple was perfect. The smoke level was perfect. The pinch of sea salt in the coffee was really good. The touch of coconut was so nice. Oh, I loved it.
I was enjoying finding the little bits of whipped cream that had a crystal of sea salt.
Yes. Same.
I mean, this is like salty on sweet is like my favorite combination. Yeah. Just like, honestly, just take a chocolate chip cookie, throw a little bit of sea salt on that thing too. It's going
to
be so much better.
It needs to be a little though, because if we're turning it into like a super, I don't like that.
No, you don't
so
want
much.
It to be a pretzel. You just need a little bit of contrast in
there. I'm just sort of letting the sea salt just sort of
like fall into
tongue.
The, yeah, no, it's so nice.
Yeah.
Salty
also,
is great.
Like literally no notes on this drink.
Yeah.
It was
no, I'm tremendously pleased. I will be making this again at some point because I'm very happy with how this turned out.
I
was weary about coconut milk. When
I was a little bit too.
Can.
I was worried that it would be too coconutty because, like, I don't. I like coconut milk okay. I don't love coconut as a thing.
Same.
I do. I love both. But I will say, I think the key to that working was you use coconut milk, not coconut cream. Mm-hmm. Cream would have been a lot more pronounced as a flavor. As
That's
it was,
true.
It was just a little hint of coconut in there. Oh, it was. A lot of flavors, but they're all kept in great balance.
Are you cocoa for coconut?
I am absolutely cocoa for coconut.
I am no-co for coconut.
I am one of the fives of people that love almond joys, so.
I think did really well with that drink. Came out much better than the movie came out, so I think we can be proud of ourselves for that one thing that we did well.
Oh, yeah.
Chris, we have trouble with the synopsis of this. Wikipedia has zero synopsis
for literally
this
nothing.
And as we will discuss shortly, you cannot use the book synopsis for the movie synopsis. So, Chris, can you give us the little one that you found online there?
I sure can. The Mysteries of Pittsburgh is a coming-of-age story set in the faded glory of early 1980s era Pittsburgh, based on the novel of the same name by Pulitzer Prize-winning author Michael Chabon.
Shame on.
Sorry. The story opens with Art Beckstein, John Foster, floundering in his newfound post-college freedom, opting to take a job with the least amount of responsibility he can find at the appropriately titled Book Barn, while sleepwalking through the Series 7 prep courses that will speed him into a job chosen for him by his father, Nick Nolte, far away from the security of his childhood Pittsburgh. Art's fortunes begin to change when a chance encounter with a freshman roommate and part-time drug dealer, Mohammed Omid Abdi, lands him at a swanky summer party where he falls for the beautifully tipsy Jane Bellwether of Sienna Miller. I don't know how you can be beautifully tipsy,
well,
but okay.
I think you can.
The two quickly connect over a late-night plate of pie, but Jane's on-again, off-again boyfriend, Cleveland, Peter Sarsgaard, has other plans for the pair. Taking Art hostage from the dreary book barn, Cleveland threatens to throw Art off the top of an abandoned steel mill, a hideout Cleveland romantically calls the Cloud Factory. Suspended high above Pittsburgh, Art realizes that his summer has finally begun. What would become the last true summer of his life? The film captures the adventures and emotional explorations of three young people trying to find their way in a shifting world. Recent college graduate Art tries to break free from his stern father and his web of gangland connections. Cleveland Arning is the small-time street hood with the seductive delusions of grandeur. Jane Bellwether is the alcoholic beauty who simultaneously brings them together and tears them apart. I'm going to quibble on that point.
Yeah.
The cast is rounded out by Art's boss and part-time girlfriend, Phlox, which is Mina Suvari, and is anchored by a riveting Nick Nolte, who plays Art's iron-willed father, Joe the Egg Beckstein.
Joe the Egg.
That is, by and large, the plot of Mysteries of Pittsburgh. It's not a super plotty movie.
No.
It's more of like a character
movie. And it's a vibes movie. It's a hangout movie.
Right. Just real quick, I'll do the... I know you kind of did all the prominent characters, but John Foster is the lead Art Beckstein. Peter Sarsgaard is Cleveland. Sienna Miller is Jane. Mina Suvari is Phlox. And Nick Nolte is Joe Beckstein. Aside from that, it's really just like, what, Mohammed? Like, that's it.
Who was only really there in the beginning.
In, like, one scene, yeah. Like, beyond that, it's literally, like, none of these people actually fucking have names. Everyone here is just, like, restaurant man or something like that. So I don't think there's a whole lot we need to go into as far as, like, actors in this movie, so that's good. That being said, this was a book. This was a book once. This was a book that people liked.
Apparently a good book.
Yes, it is a good book. I have read the book a couple times. I skimmed it this past weekend so I could try and remember. It was a... movie, when I saw this, I remember it being very different from the book, but I wanted to read the book again to see fully, like, how much that was the case.
It seems like quite a bit of screen.
It's very different from the book. So here's the thing. I'm going to give, like, a real quick breeze through of the book itself. In the book, Jane is a relatively minor character, as I said. She leaves the plot for a lot of... much of the book, she's not even there because she's doing other things. Because, again, she's, like, the fifth or sixth most important character. She doesn't matter that much. Cleveland is a fairly major character in most of the way that he is in the movie, except that he is not queer or bi, whatever Cleveland is in this movie. The character of Phlox, who in this is Art's boss at the book barn, is just a person who works at a campus library who he has a relationship with. Arguably, she is the second or third most prominent character in the book. She's not as... I would say crazy as Phlox is in this movie. She's a little kind of quirky, perhaps, but she's not as much of a raving lunatic as I think she comes off in the movie. The other major character, I would say, is named Arthur, who is someone who Art meets in the beginning of the book at a campus library, becomes friends with him. Arthur is gay, and throughout the book, Art is involved in sort of a love triangle between Phlox, who he is ostensibly dating, and Arthur, who he starts to realize he has feelings for as the book progresses. Arthur is kind of, like, in the beginning, like, tries to make a little bit of a pass at him, and then when Art says, like, I don't believe I'm gay, he's like, okay, cool. And then later, of course, you know, certain things happen. They sort of, like, work out their feelings for each other, and they kind of are in a quasi-relationship as well. Everything sort of falls apart because, similar to this, Cleveland dies in an incident with a heist, which we'll talk about briefly. Art, the narrator, kind of chooses to be with Arthur, but their relationship falls apart toward the end of the book, and it's sort of just covered as, like, a post sort of thing where they leave Pittsburgh and they realize beyond the sort of setting that they had with their other friends, like, they don't have a whole lot keeping them together. And they just sort of fall apart. So the book itself, again, not very plotty. I would say the broad strokes of this book kind of correspond to the movie in terms of, like, the overall beats that are happening. Like, if you could just say, this is Art's journey and this is what happens. He falls in love with a man. He falls in love with a woman. A guy dies at the end. He has a dad who's a gangster. In the end, like, he realizes that, like, innocence is over. Yeah, the broad strokes of that are pretty much the same. I would say the particulars of it are not really at all. The one thing I think that the book does super well is it has this really interesting sense of something I think we can all relate to, this concept of the weird sort of vibes of, like, your first summer after college has ended, where it's like, you know now that, like, you're an adult and you have to be doing adult things, but on the other hand, it's like, this is my last summer to, like, sort of be a kid, you know, to sort of hang out with my friends and just do stupid shit and not feel bad about it. But the characters are all smart enough to know that this is not a permanent situation. They're having fun, but they're kind of nostalgic for a time period that's already ending as they're, like, living in it, you know? And I think that's a very effective part of the book. The tone of the book is very, very well thought out, very well realized, and that is something I think that does not carry at all in the movie. So you do have that. That's kind of a big part of it. There's a part in the book where Art is hearing all these stories of, like, all the shenanigans that all his friends who he just met had gotten up to, and he kind of reflects on, like, oh, it sounds like the best things that you guys have done have already happened. And it's just sort of this idea that, like,
that's an interesting
everyone
idea.
Realizes that, like, now our lives are over in a certain way. And that happens literally in the end when Cleveland dies, where it's like, oh, your life is literally over at this point. It's almost like The Great Gatsby, except I like it, where it's sort of dealing with, like, this weird sort of dreamlike limbo that you find yourself in, and then something awful happens, and you're like, okay, reality, here we are.
It is, I think, an extremely relatable idea, as you were saying, that not only do you want to maybe have this, like, last summer of freedom, but there is also this sort of limbo-ish or purgatorial feeling of, I'm an adult, but for the first time outside of my childhood, I don't have an overarching structure pushing me forward.
Yeah, definitely.
I don't have a schedule that's being set from some external entity. And I think that's a really fertile headspace for a story, especially because, you know, obviously people have all different kinds of reactions to that situation.
Sure. Yeah, no, I definitely agree with you. I think I think for a lot of people, I don't want to, like, speak for you guys, it's a very sort of memorable time in your life where you are, on the one hand, you're thrilled that you just completed this thing. Like, yeah, I fucking did it. I graduated from college.
You're
and then you also have this, like,
terrified.
Vague feeling in the back of your head, like, oh, fuck, now what?
Yeah.
Now I don't have this protected environment to live in anymore. I think that's probably one of the reasons why I responded to the book very well. It really feels like it hits my memories of what that time period in life was like. And I think that's something that probably for a lot of people who did read it, that's probably something that they connected to.
Is the book also set in the early 80s?
Yeah. The book was written by Michael Chabon when he was like 22.
Oh, okay.
So it was literally like, as it was happening, he was kind of writing it basically. So yeah, it's set in the 80s in Pittsburgh.
And has he, like, publicly said, like, yeah, some version of this...
I don't know. I don't know, to be honest.
Okay.
I know I told you earlier that he said that he had been in a relationship with a man
That's
at one point before being married to a woman. It's sort of easy to also think when in the book you have, like, the main character Art who meets a character named Arthur. It's very easy to think that, like, someone named Michael met a Mike at one point,
right.
And you're just sort of like, oh, that's a thing, right? Like, that's something I'm putting in here. It's you know, I'm always kind of reluctant to read too closely into the works of fiction that someone has written and then be like, but, like, this is really about you, isn't it? You know? But it does feel like there is definitely some aspects of himself in this.
Okay.
It feels like if you wanted that to carry into the movie, that tone, I feel like you need to start with, like, showing the before times.
Uh-huh.
Yes. That's fair, yeah.
Like, I think you need to start in college. Like, I think you start with, like, the last day of college.
Right. The
right.
very tail end of it,
yeah.
Where you're just sort of like, yeah, we did it. So then
and
you're
like,
sort of like...
get a taste.
Right,
yeah, get a
yes.
taste and understand, like, what this character is sort of escaping / being set loose from.
Yes.
Or if you can't do that... you hire an actor who can
sure.
give you some hints.
Right.
Give
right.
you some indicators.
I mean, I would also say that if you can't do that, you should be writing voiceover that is conveying that intelligently instead of just using voiceover to, I guess, tell
God.
You
tell
what
you
the plot.
Are?
Yeah. Right. It's basically like the voiceover in this movie seems to mostly exist
it's
to sort of just like tell you what's happening. It's like
it's a
real like tell, don't show.
It's so aggressively expositional. And
yeah.
then on top of that, if there was any style... energy, whatever, to the VO, I might feel a little differently about it.
Yeah, it's a couple of things. It's like either the voiceover when you introduce a character has to be like so good,
right?
So stylistic,
right?
Like
that you don't mind it being there.
Yeah,
right.
Like the best character intro written you've ever seen,
right?
And like spoken in voiceover, or it's you don't say like, yeah, this is my college year. Freshman year roommate.
Right.
Well, and
right. No, that is, and it's also like, that happens so early too. That's the most egregious example. Like,
yes.
Oh boy, this is what we're in
well,
for, right?
Yeah.
We're in for like this character just telling us who people are in voiceover without you finding out through dialogue or any
right.
other means. Or again, maybe it doesn't matter that he was your freshman roommate. Maybe it just matters that you know who he is.
Correct.
You need to like have, like, for example, like his name is Muhammad.
Yeah, Momo.
He shows up and
yeah.
then the voiceover is like on the third night of call of like sleeping in the same room Muhammad did. And then it's like the craziest anecdote
right.
I've ever heard. And that tells us exactly who he is.
Yeah,
and
right.
that he was your roommate.
Right, and and it also like it can explain your relationship with
Correct.
Him too. Like you and I like and I thought that was great. And like I
yeah,
did
yeah,
the
yeah.
thing too, or I was like, whoa, you're nuts. No, thank
well,
you.
And it's just without any style, or really, I mean, the actual written words of the VO are is incredibly
yeah.
prosaic and basic and root.
Right.
And
so
it, yeah.
It all just, what lays bare is that it's such a naked mechanism being leaned on.
Mm-hmm.
And it does call to mind that usual, like, isn't that supposed to be like a stereotype of like everyone's like first script has like way too much VO in it? That really comes through here, where if you're going to use VO, then make it fucking entertaining. And then right. if you're going to have your main character, your main actor, your lead actor, read the VO, all of it.
Don't just stand there staring.
Yeah, right. Thank you. And then also, when he's in there, like, having to record this to loop over the scenes as shot, don't do the David Fincher give me less thing. We need him to be giving us more.
Right. I think he's trying to convey sort of malaise or stagnation would be my guess, but it just comes off as boring.
Flat.
Right. Yeah. It just comes off as like, go girl, give us nothing.
Also, like, the way, the choice to use the voiceover, it is like an amateurish thing, but I think it's, in this one, I get the sense that it's like, well, this is a book written in first person.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly what I wanted to say.
We have to put in the stuff from the book.
Right, and so the book, obviously, it is, as you said, it's a first person book.
Yeah.
The book is toe-to-tip internal monologues from this character, which makes sense. That's how books often are. But I don't think any of the dialogue that he's saying comes from the book. It seems like to my recollection, at least, most of the dialogue that he is saying as his internal monologues are things that were written for the movie to cover. So it's just sort of like, you feel like you know when you're adapting this, like, yes, we need this voice because it's in the book. But then you're like, but also, I don't really want to use anything that's in the book.
That's really wild to me because I was prepared to be like, oh, okay, so this guy just did not know how to adapt from book to movie. So he just took what would have been some like internal monologue shit and put it into the movie, but that's not even true, it sounds like.
I don't believe so. It really just feels like what Lee said, where it's just, oh, book has internal monologue, I need to write internal monologue.
So,
and maybe part of that is because the movie diverges from the book in so many respects that he couldn't use what was there in the book. I don't really know.
Is there a chance there was a studio note that he just couldn't stand up to?
I wonder if that is it. I do, like, I almost wonder, was there a version of this movie that had much less voiceover, and then at some point a studio exec was like,
after
but like,
screen
right, but like, we need something. Right, exactly.
I don't know anything. Well,
yeah, please, sir, I'm an idiot. Give me something.
In fact, I kind of wonder if, did it sit on the shelf while they retooled it?
Possible,
and added
VO? Right, I think that's very possible too. I would love to know what the first screening of this movie ever
There's
looked like.
There's no way to me. I do not see a version of this movie where I'm like, God, I wish there was VO explaining
It's like, it's what, like, I'm like, there are movies, of course, as we said, that they use good VO. Right?
You haven't seen What's the Fucking Vampire Queen yet.
No, I haven't.
Had a private thought. Well, if you don't want VO, what you can have is your characters diegetically explaining to each other what has just happened that you have seen yourself 2 scenes ago.
So it's like in-universe recap.
Yeah.
Diegetic recaps.
Well, let me tell you what I just did 2 scenes ago, in case, because you weren't there, so let me, you should know.
The viewer
right,
was.
Right, the viewer there, but he was a character, we're not there, so let me catch you up while the viewer is sitting there tapping their watch.
I love,
like, come on.
Oh my God, I gotta hear about the 4 stones of the barns again.
You gotta watch this movie.
You gotta watch it. It's so insane.
Anyways, yeah. So, I mean, there are, I think, good voiceovers in movies. Like,
yeah,
this is not, all right, this
I'm
is
not trying to say it never works.
Right.
It's just very hard to make it work.
No, I agree. I mean, there are things, like, even I think this is a movie that I'm probably going to compare to Wonder Boys a lot, just because they're both based on books by the same author,
uh-huh.
also set in Pittsburgh,
uh-huh.
with some, like, queer themes.
Uh-huh.
There's university settings. But anyway, I think Wonder Boys does it very well. I think that there are a lot of movies like, you know, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, or, like, detective movies or noir movies, where the voiceover is part of the character.
Yeah, and part
getting.
Of the style as
right,
well.
Right, right. So it's not to say that voiceover can never work. It's just, I think it's more just sort of, please be wise about how you're doing this. Please infuse it with character, make it funny, do something.
This was an incredibly inept and poorly deployed use of voiceover. It was poorly written, it was poorly read, it was poorly performed, it was poorly used within the edit of the movie. Like,
yeah.
I think it also, because so much of who Art is as a character is relegated to voiceover in this movie, and the voiceover is just giving us the most prosaic details, it's like, I don't know who this person is because he's not a character outside of voiceover, and the
right.
voiceover is not helping me learn who he is as a character. It's just helping the plot, like, chug along. Well,
Go ahead. I know what you're going to say.
You don't know who he is? Because outside of the voiceover, all he does is fucking stand around.
That's true.
I really wish.
That's true.
And not respond that's to right. direct He's, right. questions.
I want anything that's going on right in front of yeah. his face. Okay, I know that we will probably get into this more specifically in characters, but yeah. it must be said, one of the biggest flaws of this movie is the lead actor.
No, right. but I'm saying this is not just, obviously the actor, obviously, yeah. we'll get into that. But I think from a fucking directing and writing standpoint, this character just is... It is the lead of the movie, and he just exists.
He's wallpaper. He's wallpaper. He's
right. No, it is one of the most egregious examples of a character to whom things happen.
Yes.
Where just like he's just sort of tagging along constantly. Things will happen to him because other characters prod him into doing
right.
something. They will prod him
yeah.
into
dragging
having sex
him
or to like do something stupid.
And here's the thing, like, and I'm not trying to like put myself into this conversation, but I related the tiniest bit because I was like, oh, a lot of times when I write without thinking about it, I create passive protagonists that are just sort of experiencing things, and then I have to go back and sort of like push myself to make them more like active and involved what's going on. It just feels like here he is purely a passive observer, and just sort of like an entry character into this world and this crazy fucking relationship he sort of just like shrugs his way into. But that's a real problem when the crux of the movie is meant to be this guy's crisis of identity and
right.
future and whatever else
right.
you want to throw into the pot there. And that needs to be interesting for the movie to work. And not only is it not interesting, it kind of just doesn't exist.
I feel like you can count the decisions he makes on one hand.
what is the...
He decides to go with Cleveland at the end. I would say that's like a
big one. He decides
that.
He decides to kiss him.
Right, he does decide to kiss him.
I guess he offers, before he decides to go with Cleveland on the heist,
mm-hmm. yeah.
he does decide to connect Cleveland to his
but
father.
But Cleveland is the one who comes in and says, please introduce me to your father. And
oh,
he's
shit,
the one who is
right.
like,
yeah.
I don't know if I should. And Cleveland's like, no, really, please. And he's like, I guess I will.
That's true. That's
so,
true,
like,
that's
it,
true.
Yes,
so that's
he,
not really even
he
a
does
decision.
Decide to, but only because another character comes in and is like, hey, do something. Like,
yeah.
pokes him with a stick.
Well,
and
he decides to get the fuck out
oh
of
Oh, my God.
Right. At
I
the
just,
end, yes.
I just realized, because I almost said, like, well, he decides to break up with Phlox, but
no.
that's not true.
No.
She basically, I mean, it's as if, it is honestly as if they realized halfway through this movie, they're like, wow, this actor cannot convey. Here, Mina Savari, what you need to do is somehow pull the realization out of thin air
right.
that this guy does not think of you as his girlfriend.
Yeah.
Right.
And listen, that actor's not going to give you a facial reaction that is going to convey that thought at all, so you need to just catch it from nothing.
Right. Yes. Pretend as though he just made an expression.
Pretend this is like an audition and you're reading to like a casting director.
Right. The casting director who's just going to sit there smoking with the script
yeah.
being like, no, of course you can meet my father, Phlox. Come and meet my father.
Yeah.
That's as much energy as he gave it. And I mean, I will never ever wish. I hate that podcasts are going in this weird visual direction where they just become like talk shows now.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I really wish we could try to convey just how his face always looks, where it's like a little bit open.
Mouth a little bit open, brow a little bit furrowed, but not so much that it looks angry, just enough that he looks slightly confused.
Like a dog.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
he was giving big Chris Klein, like, puppy energy, but not in like an energetic or engaged kind of way, just sort of a vaguely confused
yeah.
and vacant kind of way. And it's just crazy to, like, in all of Mina Savari's scenes, she's hitting, like, emotional heights of, like, 11, and he's just there, like,
huh? Doing nothing.
Yeah,
yeah right.
What?
You get this, I mean, he's sort of, like, he says that he got bored and slept with his boss, but I feel like it was probably just like he sort of stumbled ass.
I love the idea that she was just like bending over picking up a book and he's like he trips over his own feet, his pants fall down.
Whoops.
He just like slides into her and is like, uh-oh. And she's like, oh, sex? All right, I
okay.
guess so. Well, got nothing else to
yeah.
do.
It's the early 80s, just put it on in.
Right.
Yep.
No, it does. It does feel like
really
she
does feel
she
that
must
way.
Have been the one who initiated this relationship.
Yeah.
She must have literally been like, I'm bored. Would you like to have sex? And he's like,
I mean, it has to make a lot of sense why Nick Nolte has like basically constructed his path forward, because this guy can't
function.
Can't do anything.
No, that's true.
Can't make a single, just like have a single independent thought.
Yeah. And like, I think there is an arc you could write if you want that to be your character trait. If your character trait is someone who lives in an environment of such apathy and malaise that they literally don't know what to do
yeah.
with themselves, and the entire movie is about, like, how will this character finally learn? You must make a decision at some point in your life to do something, or else you're just going to end up like Cleveland, who's kind of aimlessly wandering through life, like, doing dumb shit, you know?
You know what it is? It's like a very, very poor adaptation of Perks of Being a Wallflower, but
yes.
just with, like, nudity and sex.
Yeah,
added
yeah,
in.
Yeah.
'Cause I mean, I would say Perks of Being a Wallflower is an example of passive protagonist done very well.
Yes.
At least
which also uses some voiceover,
sparingly.
Right, but it also has like the mechanic of writing letters, which I think is like a good call.
Correct.
I mean, I know it's obviously that's what the book is, the book's epistolary, but like the movie wisely realizes that if you have this going through, you can sort of, that helps you understand who the character is. And Logan Lerman was a talented enough young actor that he can also sort of use the voiceover and the choices he's making when acting without the voiceover to inform you who this character is.
But that was not happening here. And wow, it is just very crazy how like, it does not matter how much juice kind of everyone else in this movie is putting out there.
Right. And to varying degrees, I think the other people are giving something.
Something.
Yeah.
Is Sienna Miller on the lower end of that something? Yes.
I would agree, yes.
But everyone is giving something, and then it just all collapses around the hollow core of our lead performance.
Yes. Yeah. Briefly, so I just wanted to talk about the idea that the fact that this is like an adaptation.
Yes.
So I know I talked a little bit and covered some of this. What was eliminated from this in turning it into a movie? Apparently, these were all things that Ross and Marshall Thurber pitched to Michael Chabon as his concept for doing, and for whatever reason, Michael Chabon was on board with it, which stymies me. I would love to read an interview with him where he explains why. Little things like that. Just I kind of wish I knew a little bit about that. I want to talk briefly, I guess, about the gay shit in this.
Yeah.
So there's not, obviously, shockingly, there's not a whole lot of information about the production of this movie or interviews with people talking about it, because, like, why would you? But there is on a website called Pajaba.
Oh, my God.
Pajaba. Chris, are you familiar with this website?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, you know, yeah. I might get figured right there sometimes.
Okay, cool. You should look into this. But there is an interview I found on that website with Ross and Marshall Thurber.
What?
From like, 2007 or 2008.
Damn.
Because this was... The interview, I read it last night. It was after, when I told you that Max Minghella was originally cast as Art. This was after
I think would have elevated
this. Yeah, I agree. Would have been so much better. The movie probably would have been, like, thoroughly mediocre, I think, with a better actor as Art. But anyway, so it was before the movie had gone to production, but after they had cast Peter Sarsgaard and Sienna Miller and Nick Nolte, and they were trying to find a new Art because Max Minghella had dropped out relatively late in the game. But one of the things that the interviewer asks him is about the gay themes of the book and how they're pretty prevalent in the book itself, and they were wondering how it was going to be portrayed in the movie. And, like, the interviewer specifically brings up things like Brokeback Mountain having come out. And, like, I don't think Brokeback Mountain is, like, a good analog for this, because Brokeback Mountain is a one-on-one,
very different,
right, gay, dramatic relationship between these two men, where this is more just sort of a coming of age, what is my identity,
it's trying to figure that shit out. It's more sexually fluid than explicitly, like, gay.
Right, because it's not just two characters. It's three characters, and it's not the best example, but it was something that they had brought up. And Ross and Marshall Thurber says something along the lines of, like, and I think he's coming at this from a sort of early 2000s perspective of, why does it matter? Not in the sense of, why does gay stuff matter, but, like, why does the identity of your lover matter?
Right.
I think that was something we were very big on at the time, where it's just sort of like, look, I don't care if you want to be with a guy, be with a guy. Does it matter to me? No, it doesn't matter to me. He's not entirely wrong, I would say. Like, I don't think the gay shit in the movie is minimized because he's, like, homophobic or stupid or something. I think he's coming out from that perspective. But the thing of it is, I think this is a movie set in the 80s where it does matter. Like, it does matter if you're gay in the 80s, because there's some bad shit going down with the gay community in the 80s that I think you have to be a little bit aware of. Even if it's not affecting these characters yet, but it's something that you, there is sort of a dramatic irony, because you as a viewer know this is happening. We've got Reagan in office. All this shit is going to come down. And even if it wasn't for that, it's relevant because the central character doesn't consider himself to be gay. In the book, he says something that when he was younger, he kind of wondered if maybe he was gay because he wasn't feeling connected to women. It was just sort of like, is this what I'm into? And then decided, like, at a young age, like, I don't think I am. And then obviously later comes the realization that, well, I'm at least a little interested in this. So if nothing else, it matters to this character because he's never envisioned him being this way. And then he finds out, I could be this way. I think that's a pretty big impact for someone to have in their life, to realize, like, I have ruled this thing out entirely, not going to happen. And then you realize, oh, I guess it could happen.
Totally.
Right. Even if you never have a relationship with a man again, it's like, this did happen to you. You know, it could happen. I think that's the important thing that this movie misses about the gay stuff, where it's a big deal in the movie because it puts him in the middle of friends who are in a relationship together. Mm-hmm. You know, like it's so much different in the book when it's like with two characters who are just kind of friends with each other, but don't really interact. Whereas in the movie, it feels more of the guy and the girl at a bar sliding up to you and be like, hey, yeah, my girlfriend and I, like, saw you at the end of the bar. And so it really kind of feels like that in the movie, except both the guy and the girl didn't talk to each other other beforehand, no. And, like, approached him separately and be like, hey, really feeling your vibes, bud.
It is sort of that way. Well, and I kind of want to commend the director for at least trying to take a non-judgmental seat on this. I do think it's a worthwhile question to be like, do you necessarily need to label this if you are more sexually fluid? And I think that's especially a good question to ask when your character is more largely wondering about who they are and trying to figure that out.
Right.
It just kind of sucks how it was done in this movie, and that it's more just like a complication for the love triangle less than it is about really anyone's identity.
Right.
Well, I think for me what throws me is how it starts off, the dynamic between the three of them starts off as like, we're all so chill together.
Right.
We all have chemistry. And then like, he's attracted to one or both of them. And then there's like that scene where he watches them have sex.
Yeah.
And then,
And
then like, Cleveland is just like furious.
Right. So yeah.
And it's like, you guys were like about to bang earlier.
Right. So that's right. So that's, I think that's kind of like a big, really weird scene in the movie where, as you said, it's like Art coming out of the bathroom, walking through the house that they're staying at, and he hears them having sex.
Yeah.
He sees that their door is like partially open. He pokes his head in. Cleveland and Jane are having sex. Cleveland looks up at him and like they share a look before Art backs off.
And given the context of them nearly kissing in the rain in the car before Jane pulls up in her absolutely incredible bug.
It's a great bug.
You have no reason to believe this will be an issue for anyone involved.
Right. Like, I feel like there are any number of ways that I would believe the next scene of that would go. It could end with Cleveland coming in and just being like, hey, that was weird. Sorry about that. Next time we'll close the door. End of scene. It could end with Cleveland coming in and being like, hey, would you like to have sex with me
too? I think that would be kind of weird for Cleveland to react that way, because he definitely didn't have a problem with Art seeing him get blown by some guy in the punk club.
That's true.
So, and because afterwards he was like, is there something you want to say to me? Is there something you want to ask about? And he's clearly trying to like lead him into a thing. So then what makes this different?
Right.
And why are you suddenly a character who's offended or angry about this sexual attraction?
It feels like something happened in between that scene and the scene that follows it, which is Art is standing in the kitchen. Cleveland runs in like angry and starts like yelling at him. Jane is crying. Cleveland's like throwing shit around.
It feels like we're in the middle of a scene.
Right. No.
Like,
I almost kind of wonder if the first version of this movie was a half hour longer and so much shit got trimmed out from it to the point
that
like things are inexplicable now.
I totally see that.
Yeah. So I don't know if maybe that's it or not, but it's so profoundly weird that he goes out into the kitchen and just starts yelling at Art, being like, what? Like, you want to have sex with me too? Well, I feel like you were kind of giving him the vibes
and
there.
You kind of set the table for it, dude.
Right.
Like, you go on this like boys weekend and you're clearly egging to fuck him. Like, there was not a single, and maybe it's just our lead performer not being able to rise to the same level and put any doubt in there, but never for a second feel that Art is initiating a relationship with either of them.
Yeah.
They're these kind of much larger and more dominant personalities in both Jane and Cleveland that seem to be sort of pulling him into a thing. And is Art interested? I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But I will also just want to go back to the watching them have sex scene for just one other angle. It is framed, scored, shot. Everything about that sequence leads you to believe he's discovering something. He's maybe realizing for the first time more explicitly that he's into Cleveland, or that he's at least maybe into both of these people equally. Who knows? And it's just such a tonal whiplash that doesn't work to then have it be a confrontation, an angry confrontation about that.
Right.
And it's also weird that, like, Jane is crying, because I'm like, well, I kind of got the vibe from your character. You were sort of expecting this to happen between Cleveland and Art. So just like...
Right. Like, my read is that, like, she is distraught because Cleveland is angry, but I don't know why Cleveland is angry.
Correct.
So like,
everything we know about Cleveland up until this point would suggest he'd be game for this 100%.
Right. Or at least not care.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
I think for me, the worst thing about that from a writing standpoint is that, again, it's another scene of Art just fucking not, like, Cleveland yelling, and Art is just like, and it's like, that is the scene where you need to fucking spit some words out. So.
Yeah, exactly. After that, it ends with him and Jane, like, in bed together. Not having sex, but, like, he's holding her in bed as she's distraught about this. They hear a noise in the kitchen. They go out. Cleveland is, like, fucking some random woman on the countertop. And scene ends. Which is, like,
it's such a weird place.
Right. And it ends up, like
and
Jane...
And then it's, like, Chiron, August.
Right, and then, like, then it's the next month. It's so insane that, like... this confusing fight has happened. There's been a little bit of a moment where, like, Art and Jane are having some kind of connection, I guess. Jane is trying to have a connection with Art, and Art's just lying there. And then they see him fucking some random-ass woman in this house, and it's Jane's just sort of like, and then it ends. And it's like, this is where we're ending it? I still don't know what happened. You're telling me that we're moving on to the next section of the movie?
It's elliptical in the worst way.
Yeah.
And it's elliptical in the most subtractive possible way. Yeah. It's also just so frustrating to me. I also just think it's bananas that later when... I feel like we could have gotten there a more organic way,
or,
but
I mean,
okay.
Like, what if Cleveland just left after that scene, you know? Like, if there's any number of things, like, if Cleveland had just left, and then you just have Art and Jane in bed together, like, holding each other, and then... Then we just say, like, and that's it.
I also just want to point out that the movie gets in its own way with this, because they obviously the movie wants us to believe it when Jane is like to Art, like, do you love him about Cleveland?
Right.
And Art's like, long pause. Yes. Up until that point, we've really only seen him mostly just hanging out with Jane. So where are we supposed to draw this revelation from? And then...
Well, I think the thing from Cleveland comes from the lake house. It all comes from that, right? Like, that's kind of where we're getting most of it from. Because then, really, Cleveland's kind of out of the picture, I think, until he shows up again with the gun and shoots the vase that the guy is going to throw at Art. That's my vague recollection. Maybe I'm misremembering how the plotting worked. But all of his feelings for this character are stemming from that one... time,
right.
I guess. Really, that's
well,
like the
that's
one
what I'm
thing.
Saying. It doesn't make a lot of emotional sense to me,
right.
Because then you've also visually shown us with him, with, or I'm sorry, Art with his other love interest.
Right.
And then we're supposed to turn and be like, well, I've loved him since this unconsummated, unaddressed moment at the cabin.
Right, after which he yelled at me and fucked a woman and left.
So, like, and from that I'm supposed to take you're in love with him?
Right. So I think this is probably like another adaptational flaw, where in the book you kind of give equal shrift to both his relationship with Phlox and his relationship with Arthur, with like both
that's more interesting
his gay relationship and his straight relationship. And it's sort of him kind of being like, I think I'm in love with both of these people. I'm spending time with both of these people. Even if he doesn't like physically consummate his relationship with Arthur until toward the end of the book,
mm-hmm.
it's still sort of like there is this unspoken thing. In the movie, this is almost all entirely replaced by I'm hot for Sienna Miller. So like the gay stuff in the movie is almost an afterthought. And the real plot device that keeps the movie rolling is his feelings for Sienna Miller.
That's
who is
true.
He sees her at the party. He's hot for her there. He wants to hang with her. He continues to hang with her. In the book, the scene that like leads to him having this realization about how he feels about Arthur is that they're both at a pool. There is this lengthy passage where he's just describing how Arthur's body looks to him. And then it basically ends with him being like, oh boy, like, I just realized something about myself here. And in the movie, you don't get really anything like that with Cleveland. You get like the two scenes, the one in the car, and then you get the one where he's bandaging his head.
Mm-hmm.
But the closest thing you get to something like that is I think the scene where Sienna Miller's sunbathing on the cloud factory, and it's just him looking over her body the entire time. So it's almost, even if you didn't intend to do this, you've replaced this scene
mm-hmm.
of him looking at a guy's body and being like, oh my, I think I'm into this, with him looking at a woman's body and being like, yup.
I also just want to point out, it's just a bummer to me that the kind of gay, queer, or whatever, love
mm-hmm.
interest is such a shitbag we're not supposed to like, whereas we're clearly supposed to love Sienna Miller.
Yeah.
And I don't think that was necessarily intentional. I just think the director and / screenwriter is very inept.
Yeah.
And it does not help when you have an equally inept lead actor, but that was just such a bummer to me that I'm like, you give us a little gay shit, but it's so complicated by how, like, clearly messed up and bad news Peter Sarsgaard is. And then he just dies.
Yeah.
In the most kind of ridiculous, out-of-nowhere fashion. I have to imagine this was better teed up in the book, but the heist as it plays out in the movie is such a wrenching turn from where we're at. It just becomes a different movie.
Right. I mean, I think the thing that, again, the book does better than the movie, it comes off, I think, as a little less out-of-nowhere in the book than it does in the movie. It's a little more ambiguous in the book because Art is not there for the first part of it. He's only there at the part on the cloud factory. You most of what you get from this in the book is him piecing things together after the fact as to like what must have happened.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps unsurprisingly, the movie flattens a lot of ambiguity that the novel is playing with for that sort of thing. I wanted to kind of briefly talk also a little bit about the direction of this movie before we go into characters.
It's atrocious.
Yeah, it bad. It bad direction. Direction bad.
I'm not trying to say I could do better, because what the fuck do I know, but...
See, before the channeling, the ending of that scene with him having sex on the counter with a woman, then it cuts to black, and then it just says August.
Right.
And then it's Nick Nolte again, and you're like, what the fuck?
Right, what just happened? Like, what happened in between then and now?
Yeah, you can't... That, I need more.
Right, it's like, you're cutting away from interesting things happening
right.
because you don't know how to handle it or something, maybe?
Basically.
But I mean, even...
I don't think he knew how to end that scene.
I wouldn't be surprised. I would also say that just in terms of sort of the visual sense that this movie has, like, one thing I threw out at you guys when we were watching this is just, like, this is ostensibly the 80s. It does not feel like the 80s
no.
at any
there's
yeah,
little
feel,
moments.
Right. Like and I know
hairstyle is
right,
kind of 80s.
That's probably like budget as much as anything. Like
yeah.
it's very difficult if you have a low budget to try and make something feel like a different time period, especially if it's I think one that's kind of close to the current one.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you're doing it in the 40s, you can be like everyone wears suits all the time. The
right.
girls are in full-length dresses and like old cars, but when it's the 80s it's a little like more trying.
Right.
But you can't quite handle it. But the other thing that I find profoundly weird is that, and I know this is me coming from this city and bringing all my baggage
of
with
course.
Me to Boston from Pittsburgh, is
you're
that,
loud.
Like, I know, I didn't want to leave it all there, Chris. is that it has, the book has such, it's almost as though Pittsburgh is the fifth girl, where, in the books, it feels like it's such a relevant thing where at the time, like I think even you said in the synopsis, at the time Pittsburgh was basically having an identity crisis because the steel industry
mm-hmm.
had died out and it was just sort of like, fuck, like what is our town now at this point
yeah.
now that this is entirely gone? So like that almost thematically suits like what's happening in the movie where like all these characters are like, well, I thought I was one thing and now another thing has happened. How the fuck do I respond to this sort of thing? And so this movie is shot on location in Pittsburgh. Great. I love it when movies shoot on location. No complaints about that in theory. I would say it's so badly directed that it feels like this could have been shot in Toronto for all
yep.
that matters. Like, it doesn't feel like there is a strong sense of place in this movie. There's like three or four locations where I'm kind of like, I'm glad you shot on location. When they go see Jane in concert, it's at the Hall of Architecture at the Carnegie Museum.
That's everything.
Yeah. And that's one of those things where I'm like, I'm glad you did that because that's an interesting visual location. It's this hall with like large plaster casts of architecture from all around the world. That's cool. I wish the camera had pulled out more to show you what this room was. And all the Nick Nolte's fucking scenes at the Lamont, they're at a restaurant on top of Mount Washington that overlooks the city of Pittsburgh. Why not fucking pull back and
know.
Show what you're looking at in the window?
Yeah.
It's just like, it's insane that like this restaurant, the only thing this restaurant is known for, which is a pretty mediocre restaurant, is that it's in a great location. Why not show the thing that it's looking at? But instead you immediately do these like close-ups of Nick Nolte
yeah.
the entire fucking time. I don't understand how you're so bad at this.
It drains character out of places that are offering character.
Right, it's just like you've
like...
made everything feel so anonymous.
Also, I feel like they shot all the Lamont scenes in like a day.
I'm sure they,
I mean?
I'm sure Nick Nolte was there for like 2 days tops,
right?
It's like, they did the scene in the hotel with the other gangsters the next morning.
Did, like, the car thing.
Right, the scene
like,
where he's going to get Art from the police station is like, Art, get in the car.
God, the Lamont had no character in this at all.
No.
It was just sort of where these dinners would keep
right,
happening.
And it's almost one of those things where, like, these things also connect to what I think the themes of the story are. Where, like, the Lamont is an old restaurant that feels like it has not really been updated since, like, the 70s or the 80s. This character, Art's dad, stays at these old hotels and goes to these old restaurants because he is clinging to this idea of what life was like when he was a kid
mm-hmm.
that he thought it would be, and now it's something different. And so he's trying to preserve this concept of, like, I'm this guy who stays in this old-fashioned hotel where they bring you coffee and a newspaper in the morning, you know, and, like, that sort of shit. I think these things could matter if you tried to make them matter,
yeah.
but they're not mattering.
The direction is just so messy and sloppy and not thought through, it doesn't
yeah.
feel like. There was no unifying vision here.
Maybe this is not your strong suit. Maybe, because
right.
the guy was in his 20s at the time too, so I get why you would read this book and be like, this touches me. I relate to this. But that doesn't mean that you can do it. I don't know. That's kind of, I think, the big hang-up I have of direction in this movie, that it feels so anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
That if not only is Thurber, like, not directing this well, it feels like he is actively hurting it.
Yes.
His director choices.
And, like, undermining his own movie.
Right.
Yes.
It's just, there are so many tight shots of everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Barely letting you see a sense of place, a sense of
there's no
setting.
Confidence. He didn't
right.
think, it almost felt like he was like, well, I don't know where I would put a medium wide or a master shot, so
yeah.
I'm just not gonna do them at all.
Yeah. Just avoid. Avoid, avoid.
We're just gonna do tight to medium close-ups.
Right. Yeah, we're either gonna it, either like the character's whole body is in the frame or the upper half of their body is
right.
in the frame.
And we're going to do a lot of like shot reverse shot. It goes beyond characterless. It's, yeah, it actively harms the movie. Ugh.
I guess the last thing we'll just dip into real briefly here is characters and performances. So okay. I know we kind of started on John Foster as Art Beckstein.
Not a surprise.
John Foster as Art Beckstein.
As Lee said, when she looked him up and she was like, oh, this was it, huh?
Yeah, it seems like, yeah, I actually, let me look real quick because I am curious, like, what the fuck else? This guy really, yeah, he was in, like, Life as a House.
Sure.
Aside from that, it's really just not a lot of big shit. Like I said, I think he's in a band now or something.
And maybe that's his strong suit.
Maybe it is. His brother is Ben Foster, you know?
Yes.
So maybe his brother
who's like
the genes.
Good director or a good director, actor. Good actor.
Yeah. So maybe that worked out for him. But
I would not have guessed
they don't look
brothers.
That similar. Yeah.
But no, he's terrible. He's bad in this and he's also disgust.
As I said, I think with a better art, you would have at least a 2.5 to 3-star movie just because the actor would be giving you something, even with all the other shit.
It's Lee, I think, hit the nail right on the head. It's the after watching them have sex scene just completely solidifies this actor's problems. Or you could also use the Phlox losing her shit in the office. This actor is coming at him with so much, and he is giving zip,
right.
zilch back.
Right. There's just right this
there's
like
no
blank.
There's no physical choices being made.
Yeah.
It's like an acoustic soundproofing
right.
in a wall.
Or just again like
just getting absorbed.
Just absorbing.
We keep going back to like dogs, but it's like yelling at a dog, and the dog just doesn't get why you're mad at it.
Yeah,
you're just like, you made a mess on the carpet.
And
the dog's like,
you're just getting a blank look back.
Right, yes. It's like, that's very bad you did. The dog's like, I cannot grapple with what you're telling me.
It was wild. It was some of the worst acting I think we've covered on this podcast. Like,
yeah.
Oof.
I think it is for me, that in the direction, well, I don't know, I was going to say that in the direction of the writing, but like, wow, we're really technical, but like, this is a pretty big misfire for me.
Well, it has like a 3.9, I think, on Rotten Tomatoes.
Out of
that, I would not surprise
out
me.
Out of
really bad.
Out of 10, I assume.
Oh,
yeah,
that makes sense.
Yeah.
Out of 10, not out of 5.
Yeah, no, that
for
would,
a second I thought you meant out of 5, and I was like,
that would be shocking.
That would be like some like Gremlins on IMDb, like
fucking
voted.
Yeah, right. Peter Sarsgaard as Cleveland, who I think is delivering probably the best performance. In the movie.
Probably agree with that.
Yeah. I like what he's doing.
He embraces the chaos of this character pretty well. Although, I mean, he's ultimately just boxed in by a character that's not very well realized in terms of the screenwriting.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of can't make heads or tails of the character.
Right.
I kind of like vacillates between like, I'm like a sort of beatnik poet
guy.
Rake type, yeah.
Rake. And also I'm like a sort of pathetic street level criminal.
Yeah, it does feel like it's sort of hard to rationalize these two sides of him.
I just want to get out of the life, man.
Right. It sort of feels like on the one hand, he's like...
He switches that. It's like, well, where's all of that?
Right, where did this come from all of a sudden?
And there's also not enough connective tissue in the script to reconcile these two sides of the character. And I think Sarsgaard does the best he can with that situation, but you can only do so well.
He has this sort of air of like, ooh, danger maybe, but then when it's the crime side of him is revealed, it's not that, it's like, oh, I just want to get out.
Yeah,
no.
it feels right. Again, this speaks to like the whole like, is there a half hour missing of this movie where it's like, is there a version of this movie where his wild swings make some level of sense or something like that?
And it's sort of the movie basically just is deciding for you, by the way, Jane is the right choice here,
right?
Just because even if she's disappointing in some kind of way, they don't like characters and assassinate her in the way they do Sarsgaard.
No,
that's certainly true.
And yet he's like, and yet Art's like all in at that point.
All in?
Yeah.
It makes no sense. Like, I don't even understand where he's getting the chips for that one, you know? Like, but yeah, I think he does as well as he can. I kind of love his look in this movie a little bit.
No, I do too. I mean, again, I think this character should be played by someone younger, not even taking into account the fact that in the book this character is like 25. I just think it makes a little more sense if this character is younger, because like there are certain things you do when you're in your 20s versus when you're in your 30s
that
are a little more explicable.
Shape.
Right, exactly. Like, it's a little easier to see a character as a fuck up who's making a lot of bad choices and then also panics about it when you're 20 versus when you're 30. And it's like, well, you've had some time to be an adult
figure this much
and understand
out.
What you're doing. Yeah. So it's, the scene at the end where he's panicking about what he's doing,
I don't know,
really,
man.
Just kind of comes out of nowhere at that point.
Yeah.
So Sienna Miller as Jane.
I think another character written really poorly.
Yeah.
I just can't.
sort of manic pixie autopilot.
You kind of hit on that where it's like a slightly grittier version of it.
Yeah.
Like,
right, because I think the thing is with a manic pixie, you expect this character to do weird shit and the guy's like,
yeah.
Oh, Jane plays the violin? That's,
well,
is that it? Is that all we get?
Here's what I'll say. Obviously, the script isn't giving us enough to fully even flesh her out as a manic pixie dream girl.
Yeah.
But that is, I would argue, unmistakably the intended vibe. It's definitely the vibe of Sienna Miller's performance.
Sure.
The way that she's just supposed to be this sort of, like, effortlessly charming, slightly bohemian. I mean, I guess she's enticing him into a world that's a little wilder than business school or whatever. But, yeah, just, like, it's an autopilot manic pixie dream girl. Not so manic, I suppose, but depressed pixie
yeah,
girl.
Yeah,
yeah,
like a manic depressed.
Yeah, manic depressed pixie dream girl. Yeah.
And it's just this character really only exists to be the object of both Cleveland and Art's affections. I think a lot of what we know about her is projected upon her more than is given to us in performance
yeah,
or writing.
The thing that I find a little bit weird, it's like, it's not that you don't see this in the movie, but like there's that point at the beginning where after they go to the punk club, Cleveland says something about Jane, like, oh, she drinks too much sometimes. Like, you've noticed that, right? She is, like, passed out on a couch in the club. She did crash out. And then later, whenever they call Art to the restaurant where they're at, she seems drunk, I guess, at that point, because she's just sort of, like, asleep on Cleveland while this is happening. Right, no, that's the thing, too. It's like, they're, like, he's telling me that this character drinks too much. Even in the synopsis you gave, it implies that they're acknowledging this character.
Beautifully
tipsy. This character drinks too much. But I'm kind of watching this, I'm kind of like, does she drink too much? Or
that's
like,
the thing.
Compared to who?
She's at a punk show, and then she's on the couch, and she's like, all kind of tired, and she says she doesn't feel so good. And I was like, uh-oh.
Right. Roofie, what happened?
Exactly.
That's what I thought, too.
And then he just walks away, and he's like, well,
I'll go get your boyfriend.
Your boyfriend. and also wait outside.
Right, and then, like, not wait with you. I'll just, like, you're good here, right, while I leave for a while.
Yeah.
You just passed out on a couch surrounded by strangers. Nothing bad will happen.
No, you're cool.
Yeah.
Don't worry.
And
we're fine.
I can't believe that doesn't come up in the movie.
Yeah.
I know.
No, it does. It does feel like a moment where you're sort of like, oh, this is going
to
be bad news.
There's the thing later where she goes to the restaurant. Mm-hmm. They're at the restaurant. There's like an outburst.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Wait, that's the one that, like, Art gets called down to because they had a fight.
Yeah.
Those are the only two moments where you get the impression, oh, this character might drink to excess sometimes.
Yeah.
It's not like you see her really drinking by herself or something. Or, like, you know, in the restaurant with Nick Nolte, it would be one thing if she was very quickly downing a drink or something.
Well, like, I guess that's what he says, to be fair. He says she drinks too much sometimes.
Yeah. Indeed.
She's an alcoholic.
Indeed. Sometimes she do drink too much.
You know.
Very good point.
Yes. The story about this particular performance, I don't think this is a very good performance.
Yes.
One of the things about this movie that was kind of a thing is
this about how she trashed Pittsburgh?
Yes.
Yeah.
So the thing is that while she was filming this movie in Pittsburgh, I think she, like Rolling Stone or something, was doing an article on her, and they had sent someone to interview her in Pittsburgh, and she spoke very disparagingly about the city, where she said something like, I can't believe, like, this is where my career is right now. Like, you're going to go back to your trendy New York apartment, and I'm going to be in Shittsburg. And they published this because she said it became a thing because the mayor was like, we've been very, like, accommodating with them.
What the fuck's the end?
Right. And she, I think, later apologized for it, but the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette ran the headline, semi-famous actress dumps on Pittsburgh, which I think was a really funny headline.
Oh, that's such a good read, too. Oh, man. Because she was kind of on the cusp of really
happening. It was, like, right, that was the thing we were kind of talking about, too. It felt like Sienna Miller was kind of going to become, like, kind of a little bit of, like, an indie darling.
She was at least being served up in a way that we really don't do for a lot of actors anymore, where it's all kind of being laid out for them,
right?
And the media to some extent is being sold on this actor as the next big thing or
right.
the next whatever. But man, did that peter out.
Yeah, definitely.
At least in terms of this movie, it's like a fine performance, but it's sort of just like, I don't really feel like it's going beyond what's maybe in the script.
I would agree.
Even taking into account that the script is not that great. So.
Yeah. I got briefly, real quick, Mina Suvari as Phlox, who truly, like, the character's a lunatic.
I gotta be honest with you, though.
She's nuts.
For me, she is tied with Nolte as second best performance. I don't know. I think the movie's a little mean to her, to be honest.
Oh, I agree.
And we're invited to sort of look down on her in a way I don't like.
I agree.
I think Mina Suvari is trying her fucking hardest to, like, wring something out of this character.
Yeah.
And the fact that her main scene partner is the absolute void.
It's just a cardboard cutout sitting there. Yeah.
What's his nuts, Foster?
Yeah.
My heart went out to her, especially in the like office argument scene where I was just like, Damn, you are throwing everything right in his direction.
And the character is clearly written to be kind of a lunatic. This character like basically boils down to, like, boy, like, women are crazy, yeah, am I right? Yeah. Like, don't have sex with a crazy woman or she's going to be obsessed with you.
And she's so out loud, horny, and sexual. The movie's clearly teeing her up to be kind of, like,
knocked
out
of
less
right
for that.
Right, yeah, exactly, exactly. So, like, I think Mina Suvari is trying her best to, like, give this something. Like, she knows that this character is being written as ridiculous, so she's kind of going big and broad with it as well.
Which is a fine instinct.
Which it's like, again, like, I think, I can't remember what it was, but I, like, at one point, Lee, you said something like, if you can't play a character, at least play something big. And, like, I think that's what she's doing here.
Okay, at least go hard.
Right, and, like, that's kind of what she does. Like, if you can't make sense of who this woman is beyond, like, boy, bitches be crazy, am I right? You should at least, like, go a little nuts.
Yeah, we can move on in just a sec, but I do just wanted to say, I fucking love how much mustard she puts on the line of, me and your son used to fuck.
I do kind of love that scene. I love, like, Nick Nolte's, like, understated reaction all, and she's like, oh, I see, did you?
Like, hey. I want the audio cut of her, and just you hear him just go, oh.
You mean like where they take one half of the dialogue out?
Did you?
And you would be like, are those lines or is that a gravel tumbler?
Yeah, is that an air conditioner starting or something?
It's a 50-50 with that character because, like, yes, it's insane to think the fact that you're someone's manager and you're, like, fucking him in the office that you're dating, but also, my guy, you're having over for dinner and you don't think that you're dating someone?
Right. No, that's the insane thing. It would be one thing if they were just having sex occasionally at the bookstore. But then you see that, like, she's at his apartment a lot. Like, she must have a key to his apartment.
Yeah.
Or else he just leaves the door unlocked all the time. Which maybe he does.
Maybe he does.
Yeah. But, like, it is like, she is there. So, like, it's not one of those things where, like, it feels like there's a miscommunication between what we thought this relationship was. Like, she is there having dinner with him at his apartment.
Guys,
how do you not realize
this? We can only expect so much from him. He's a tabula rasa. He has 50 First States disease where his brain just resets every day.
Every 5 seconds. And
that's why he always looks like, ooh.
Lastly, just Nick Nolte.
Oh, I mean, he's given very little to do, but
he's having fun.
He's having fun.
He is. I think he's delivering, like, a good gangstery performance. The only thing I will say, and I will say this quickly because it comes back to another, like, in the book it was like this, but in the book his dad is described as this sort of almost, you would not expect this man to be a gangster. Or, and, like, to be quite clear, he's not a gangster. He just does money for the mob. He wouldn't be carrying a gun or some shit like that, you know? He is tied up in the mob. In the book, my recollection is at one point Art literally describes him as sounding like Winnie the Pooh. You almost imagine this sort of doughy, short, middle-aged man who looks completely anonymous that you would not be able to pick out, but not like Nick Nolte standing there in his suits going the entire time. Which
I would 1,000% believe is a mobster.
Right, no, completely. I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but I'm saying you've completely changed who this character now seems to be. And did you do that because you didn't get it in the book, or because you felt like this was a better choice to make? I think, frankly, the character makes more sense if he doesn't read as a mob boss. The daddy issues are still there in the book, but it feels like they're a little bit more complicated because his dad's not some sort of, like, growling grump.
Mm.
So I don't know. It just, again, goes back to flattening out themes that are present in the book. Anyways, having gone through that, shall we go to the fixes?
Yes, and I would like to go first if that's cool.
Sure.
Okay.
No!
I have a pretty simple solution.
You write it on your sleeve or something?
No.
Fix.
They're at a Greek poem, a tie in the Lamonts.
Oh, hold on. Let me put my sleeve down lower. Everyone is dying of cancer. And no, so I think I mentioned when we were watching this, this sort of feels like a toothless Bret Easton Ellis novel, which I stand by. And that actually did lead me in a direction that really informed my fix. So a book I read from Bret Easton Ellis when I was in high school, before I found out that Bret Easton Ellis is like a fucking,
yes.
I can't even get into that, but yeah. He wrote this book called The Rules of Attraction.
I've read Rules of Attraction.
It was made into a meh.
I've seen the movie. Yes, I know the movie.
So Rules of Attraction, also set in the early 80s, also kind of dealing with a hard partying culture of kids
college,
that are trying to, like, figure out what's going on with them. Very different tone and direction, just to be very clear. But there's a really cool device where there is a Patrick Bateman's brother within the world of Bret Easton Ellis verse.
I know.
And there's also a gay male character.
Mm-hmm.
And the book is just rotating through multiple different
points of view.
Right. So, and what you get is a lot of like, well, this guy dated this other person, and now you're kind of getting two different stories from both of them.
Sure.
The way that shakes out with the straight Bateman and the gay character is in the gay character's POV, they're having this beautifully tender, aching, poetic secret affair, and it completely does not come up in the straight guy's POV stories.
Right.
I love that idea.
Uh-huh.
I actually thought that was extremely clever and communicated a lot of stuff very simply.
Yeah.
And I want to employ a very similar device here. I want to make this a love triangle movie between Art, Arthur, because now I'm also hearing this, and Flux. And I want this to cover the same period of time. And this isn't necessarily a, like, you get one perspective, back up, get the next. I want to kind of intercut them. But I think that would be an extremely interesting way to, A, explore a lot of different directions within this really interesting dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that would sort of allow for, I feel like what this movie tries to do is to create a very conventional plot from what sounds like a book that is not very plotty and is much more of a character study.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this kind of structure would allow you to actually study each of these characters and to give you a very real sense of what they're experiencing and how it may be different for each of them.
Mm-hmm.
I get very frustrated in love triangle stories when it's like so clear who you're supposed to choose or I think having some true ambiguity in who you're supposed to root for would make a lot more sense. Plus, I think if you're not just focusing on one person within that dynamic as your like protagonist, you're leaving the door much more wide open for different interpretations or feelings about this. And I think it would really help drive home this idea of what I think the movie is reaching for, which is these people in these very three different situations are all trying to define themselves, figure out what's going on. And yeah, I think it would be way more interesting to just sort of have an episodic, not a plot-driven, but a very character-driven experience where we're just getting these three different perspectives within this messy love triangle.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to rest on my favorite solution lately, which is, and then they throuple.
The thing that in the book, there is a point where, like, at the end where, like, this is all coming to a head, where Art is talking to Arthur and Phlox, and it's just sort of like,
what
I love
if?
Her, I love you, can we make this work together? And both Arthur and Phlox are like, no.
Fair. Anyway.
Lee, do you want to?
I guess. Yeah, I read the book summary afterwards and I was trying to, like, reconcile and I kept getting confused. For some reason, I could not wrap my head around the Arthur Cleveland thing.
Uh-huh.
Like, and then Jane's even mentioned in the book synopsis.
I was good because, like, she's a very minor character.
Yeah. I think I was like, oh yeah, they minimized Phlox. And then I was watching the movie and I was like, wait, Phlox is a different
character. Yeah.
And then there's another woman. That's weird. And so, yeah, I got confused about, because I read the book synopsis in lack of there being a movie synopsis before, like, trying to, like, get my head around
what to expect
this stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I do think I just like the core of the three characters.
Mm-hmm.
I don't hate how it's presented in the movie. If you just pretended like they were all like that, all made sense. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no,
I think
like,
so.
If there was like a guy who was like Arthur and Cleveland Adam smashed, and if there was a guy who was Jane and Phlox, who was Jane and Phlox Adam smashed, but also like maybe neither of them, because again, I don't know who these characters are supposed to be.
Right.
Because the ones in the book are insane.
Yeah.
In the movie, rather.
Yeah.
And then the ones in the book, I don't have the insight to understand.
Sure, sure.
But like, let's just say that there's like, you know, a mysterious kind of cool biker dude who is sexually fluid and erudite, but like, does stuff that's dangerous for some reason. And there's like a woman who's sort of a bit, you know, cosmopolitan and like bohemian, and has a promising career, but also maybe goes a little too hard for her own good sometimes, and is maybe insecure.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I like the idea that this guy just gets dragged into these people's orbit and spends the summer with them. And there is that sort of, like, threesome vibe where it's less, like, a love triangle and more just him initially being attracted to her, but then realizing he's attracted to him as well. And just kind of struggling with all of that. And I think it would just deal with the complications of it, but it wouldn't be as bizarre as it's presented in the movie where it's like, I think modern movies don't handle polyamory very well.
No,
still.
Yeah, sure.
But like, it's certainly not what you see in this movie where it's like, you know, she watches them have sex and then the guy who clearly was interested in this guy anyway gets mad for some reason, really furious, and then fucks some other woman out of quote unquote revenge question mark?
Yeah, like what the, he just like went out like found a random ass woman and brought her back.
Yeah.
Like, I'm impressed by his skills, I guess.
If only we had a more defined character.
Yeah, but I think it's like this guy who has not had any drama in his life whatsoever gets sucked into these two very big dramatic people's lives. Uh-huh. I mean, I don't know, the book or whatever. Is the death important? Like, I don't really, I guess the death, like you're saying, it sort of implies like that there's consequences, that there's like,
I think it's one of the things where like, yeah, there's consequences. I think it's also sort of, again, similar to The Great Gatsby, that's the end now. Like, that's the end of like our weird limbo hedonistic period. Someone has died, so like we all have to fucking move on now.
Yeah. I don't know that I would need someone to die. I don't even know that I need the crime thing. I feel like it could just be as simple as like someone ODs or like something
which
like,
would be tied to their hedonism anyway.
Yeah, something that's like, hey guys, this was never going to be a sustainable path.
Right.
And it's like a wake up call for at least the main character, and maybe one of them it doesn't wake up and is like, I'm going to go back to doing the drugs.
Right.
You know, tomorrow. So yeah, I think I would have it just be like, he kind of comes out of that, like realizing like, okay, that was fun, but I can't live my life like that.
Sure.
So now I've got to figure out what I can live my life like and move on from that existence. So yeah, I think that's how I would end it.
Nice. Oh,
thank you. Good work.
Good
work.
Haley,
good
work. Haley, good work.
Thumbs up.
Right, so, Brandon, take us home.
Right. So I know the obvious like answer is to say do the book, which I don't want to say because the book is admittedly hard to adapt. As someone who has just kind of briefly skimmed through it, a lot of internal monologues. There's a lot of like, again, it's not a complicated plot, but it's a plot with a lot of little character moments that I feel are difficult to sort of impose a structure on. So I'm not going to just say like, please do the book instead, because I acknowledge that's a big ask to do. What I would say is I think if the story needs to be simplified, I think the way to do it is to keep the character of Arthur from the books and eliminate the character of Jane entirely so that it's just Art, Arthur, Cleveland, and Phlox. And that way you don't have per se necessarily maybe an outright love triangle. I guess you could call it that, where you have sort of Phlox representing the woman, Arthur representing the man, and Cleveland is just like the friend, the one character with whom you have no sexual or romantic tension with. It's just like, this is the guy you can talk to without any of that baggage thrown into that. I think that's kind of the ideal way to do it. You need like the three heads of this Hydra for this character to bounce off of. This sort of like Phlox quasi-Jane analog would exist where she's not his boss at a bookstore. She is someone he probably knows through Arthur, which is the way it is in the book. The thing I think about this character that's kind of interesting that comes through in the book that doesn't come through in this movie is that Phlox in the book, this character who like doesn't know what her identity really is, not in terms of like sexual, but just in the sense Arthur mentions that Art first asks Arthur like, who is this woman? He mentions like offhandedly like, oh, like she was a really hardcore Christian. He's like, she is. He's like, well, she was last week. This is clearly a woman who's like, doesn't know who she is and is trying on all these different things. They kind of say in the book, she's worried that people will find her boring. So she's like trying to grab onto these things to be like, this is who I am. And it's like, that's an interesting character. And again, that speaks to the fact that everyone in this movie is trying to figure themselves out. So I like that as a character trait. I think that's something that's entirely relevant. I think a lot of the things are issues also that I talked about earlier, where I'm talking about the direction of the movie and how it's not using sort of the themes that are thrown out in the book to any great effect. It's everyone sort of trying to realize, well, shit, now what happens next? Like, this is just a vibe that I need to come throughout the movie, and that can be done through direction, that can be done through writing, that can also be done through music. I think the score in this movie is pretty bad. It's a very sort of twinkly piano score. Pretty
it's
fucking
very anonymous.
Yeah, pretty fucking boring shit. Don't like it. Need something a little bit stronger there. Really just the tone is the biggest kind of issue I think you need to hit home with something like this. I think it should just probably still end with everyone kind of splitting up and not seeing each other, but I do like the idea that as in the book, when Art is prompted to make a choice. He chooses Arthur, which I think is kind of relevant because that does not happen in the movie. He does not really choose the man. If he is forced to try and choose one thing, he decides, I guess I'm going to try this. And it doesn't work out. It doesn't end well for them necessarily. They go their separate ways. Again, I think this is sort of a major aspect of the book that I wish the movie had to do. So if it really comes down to something, I'm going to say, try and capture that tone, try and capture that queer stuff, give Jane the heave-ho, make Phlox a little more interesting and prominent.
That honestly, I think, is a really excellent way to at least try to bring more of the book in. Even if you're not just doing a direct adaptation, it sounds like this way at least moves the movie closer to being what the book was about.
I mean, that's the thing, right? We're not fucking idiots. We know that adapting a book into a movie or anything is hard work. You're not just going to sit there, type the lines of dialogue that people are saying in the book into a screenplay and be like, now I made it. The biggest thing that you can do, I think, in adapting something is you have to like find what is the theme or the tone of the thing that you're adapting and then effectively convey that. I think the best adaptations, even if they're not faithful to the source material, are doing that.
Spiritual implications.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or like, if you're wildly changing the tone, why are you wildly changing? Like, what is your take on it that necessitates changing the tone? So like, again, similar to, I guess, John Foster's performance as Art, like, I need you to make a decision. Like, make a decision, please.
Do something, right?
As soon as you're poking with the stick, be like, do something.
Yeah,
come on.
Yeah.
God damn.
Anyways, would you recommend The Mysteries of Pittsburgh?
No.
I cannot say that.
I cannot either.
Good conscience, I cannot. I mean,
no, it bad.
You made me watch it, though.
I know, I did.
I do have to say this.
Much worse, so.
So you had it coming,
really. I would not recommend it. However, and maybe my mind is just pickled by doing this podcast.
By all those Heinz pickles that you saw in the movie.
Well, that too. I mean, and you know I love a pickle.
Or like a side of pickles. And then
it was ordered red bones.
Like a full jar's worth of
pickles. Right, when you ordered that full vat of pickles and ate them in one sitting.
It was like a pint container. Or like a liter container.
And just like the amount of brine you were ingesting.
And I had a headache.
Yeah, go figure.
I had a headache later because I was so dehydrated. But I will just say, when I was watching this, I was rubbing my hands because I was like, fuck, are we going to have some shit to talk about in this goddamn movie? I mean, this was truly, so much of this just goes wrong in an unentertaining way. But I guess, hey, if you have a podcast out there where you're going to watch bad movies, this is a great choice. Required viewing, in fact.
Truly. I mean, just watch Wonder Boys instead. Wonder Boys is such a better movie of this.
How do we buy this out in a Mysteries of Pittsburgh way?
In our thick Yinzer accents.
Oh, jeez.
No, you can't say buy me Yinzer accent. It won't read as that. But Facebook.com is not a website we're on anymore, so don't fucking worry about it. Draftback.com is our actual website, so please go there. You can find us on all the podcast streaming apps. You can subscribe to us. You can rate us, whatever the fuck they're calling it now.
Check out what Spotify's AI titles and breaks up our podcast episodes into. It's pretty
funny. It's always entertaining to see how weirdly accurate and
South
how weirdly strange.
That's my favorite one.
Oh my god.
All right, so we'll be back in 2 weeks with a mini episode. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
This is my father, Joe Beckstein.
It's a pleasure to meet you. Oh, how lovely. You're not? I'm sorry. I see. No, of course you're not.